Okay, quiet on the set, everybody. Stand by. Roll camera. Speed. Roll sound.
Speed.
Mark it. And cue talent.
Hello, and welcome. I'm Art Aldridge, and I'll be discussing This Week in Production. You may be wondering what this podcast is about and who am I. I hope to shed some light on that in the next 25 or so minutes. I feel like I have something of value to share, to give back, and that is the intention. I've run the New Jersey Final Cut Pro User Group for over 15 years. I've had a great experience doing that. The group still meets, but not as often as I'd like. My travel schedule prevents me from putting as much time and energy into those meetings as I would like to. What I like about the user group is the sense of community, the sharing, the exchange of ideas. I'm not exactly sure where this podcast will go week to week. I'm not going to be restricted to a single skill or a platform or a technology or a topic. I will draw material from things happening in my work right now. Names may be changed to protect the innocent, but if you're guilty, look out. So first, a little bit about myself. I'm 51 years old, live in the New York metro area. Got my start very early in my teens. I had a production company with my dad, who was a newspaper publisher, and he was always involved in multimedia back in the 50s, 60s, slides, radio, film to some degree, but he was always doing that as side hobby work. He made his living as a newspaper publisher and writer and journalist. I do remember going down to his basement workshop and seeing old guillotine splicers and film reels and microphones and recording equipment, film negative and film prints, and, you know, just things as a kid that were interesting. And I guess obviously it had some impact on my career, though I didn't know it at the time. It didn't really mean much to me as a young child. But my dad was very supportive. Through his publishing business, he was able to get some work with a charity organization to produce a fundraising video. Even though neither one of us had any experience in producing, he pitched and sold a video. We had no equipment. We had no script. We had no idea, though we figured it out on the fly. This was in the early 80s, and about the only format that was affordable, and I'll use that term with quotes, affordable, was industrial strength VHS. That was about as good as we can get. And we purchased a couple of Panasonic handheld cameras that had standalone outboard recorders. I don't remember the exact model, the WV3250s maybe, and the Panasonic AG2400 VHS recording machines. And we bought two cameras and two recorders, and we started shooting footage. And my dad had sort of a editorial vision for it, and we went and filmed for several months. We needed to buy some editing equipment, and again, at this point, VHS cuts only edit systems. I remember it was a Panasonic AG6300 and a Panasonic 8500 editing deck, and they were beautiful. They were big, they were loud, they had professional connectors on them. And they were expensive. I don't remember exactly the price, but, you know, in the neighborhood of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for the two machines and an edit controller. And all that let us do was cut. Cuts only editing. And that was, we were on our way to to producing a video. That project was the start of my career, because I learned a lot on that job and would obviously go on and continue to learn through my lifetime, still learning to this day. When I went to high school, because that was pre-high school for me, I went to high school in 82. The high school where I attended had just purchased a Panasonic television studio. It was all in boxes. And I remember walking down this one hall as a freshman, seeing all these boxes outside of this room with buttons and lots of levers and knobs. And for some reason, it was familiar and interesting at the same time. And I said to the teacher who was unboxing the equipment, I said, what is this? What are you doing? And he explained that they were building a TV studio and asked if I was interested in helping. I said, absolutely. And then I helped produce a daily newscast around the high school. And at that point, I knew immediately that this is what I wanted to do for my career. I went to NYU Film School, where I graduated with a film and TV degree from Tisch School of the Arts. Through high school and college, I worked at a local cable TV company producing local advertising. It wasn't glamorous, it wasn't fancy, but it was fun and creative, and by just doing sheer volume of work, you could develop skills. I was always told through high school and college that getting a job in New York was almost impossible, getting a union job was almost impossible, and that you should look for work outside of New York and get back here over time. And I would send out my demo reel on 3/4-inch tape back in those days, and I would send reels out by the hundreds. Every week I'd get TV and broadcast magazine. I think it was a Crane publication called Broadcast and TV, and there would be classified ads in the back, and I would send out 3/4-inch demo reels of my videography and editing skills, and I'd send them out to TV stations all over the country, I was trying to get a job as a promo producer or a promo production person, and I got no responses. No one was interested in hiring me, even though I thought I had a pretty good reel. No one was really interested. I did see an ad for a job in the New York area. It was in New Jersey. It was for a Spanish language TV station called Univision. And they had listed some equipment that I had used in school. And I was familiar with the editing equipment and the production equipment they were using. And I did have 6 years of Spanish, though I never really could speak fluently or write fluently. But I did have 6 years of Spanish, which I put down on my cover letter, and I sent my reel. And wouldn't you know it, I got a call back about a week later saying they wanted me to come in and interview for the position. And I was very excited. I went down, and basically they were looking for a vacation relief editor. And what that meant was that they had six staff editors who each got about 6 weeks vacation, and they needed someone to fill in for all of those editors as they went out. So I had basically about a year's worth of work that they were willing to give me. No commitment of full-time status, but it was a union job. It was a IBEW position. I had union status, and I had union pay structure with overtime and penalties and things like that. And I was working in New York at a station. So I thought that was pretty exciting. And I met people there that I still am friends with today, that I still work with today. And I was able to get other jobs in other facilities. I did a lot of shooting for network sports, NFL football type things, baseball, corporate. And I decided with some of these people that I'd met that I was going to open up a production company to do commercials. And we thought that that was something that we could do better than the the average bear, better than the average producer. So we hung a shingle out. We bought a Betacam camera, which was at that time about $75,000. And we bought a Betacam component editing system, AB Roll editing system. And we actually used an Amiga computer, an Amilink, to do the AB Roll editing because we couldn't afford a Grass Valley or a CMX or a Sony. And we had a little Sony DVE switcher that was component. So that would handle the mixing of the AB Roll edits. And it actually interfaced with a GPI trigger to the Amilink. And we were in business. We had a full-fledged production company that could do pretty high broadcast quality work. And that company was around for about 4 or 5 years. As things go in business, especially when you're a small business, you don't always get along with personalities and people who are involved in the operation of the business. So we decided to split up and go our own ways. I started just going back to freelance editing. This is in the early 90s, mid 90s. Nonlinear editing was becoming a thing. And as nonlinear systems were becoming viable for offline editing, I found that the amount of days that I could book as an online editor, because that's what I was making my living at, was an online editor, running big 1-inch rooms or D2 rooms or component Betacam rooms or interformat rooms. These were all terms that were used back then. As more producers were cutting their own offline work, the number of hours that I was getting called for online editing was being reduced. And I saw the writing on the wall. I knew that nonlinear not only was going to become the main way to edit, but I knew that the quality would be good enough to never have to go to an online room again. And Avid was making a name for itself in offline editing. But again, coming from not big budgets, big deep pockets, couldn't really afford Avid. And I had seen some demos of Adobe Premiere, and I'd used it a little bit, but I don't know, ever since the version 1 of Premiere, and I always felt Premiere looked a little cartoonish or less professional to me. Never really gravitated towards it for some reason. What system did catch my eye back in those days was the Media 100. The Media 100 had a very good picture quality, even at the offline resolutions. And they had a very simple interface, but it was professional. You could come in, get your work done, and it didn't feel childish, cartoonish, very straightforward. And so I had, and it was about a third of the price of an Avid system. So on those features alone, that seemed like a home run to me. So I had purchased a Media 100 system. Some GEMS Data Unlimited was the storage supplier. I think it was about $12,000 to buy a 8 or 12 gigabyte RAID. Yes, 8 or 12 gigabytes. That's about what we had back then. SCSI, all SCSI interface. But I saw where the industry was going, and I rode the Media 100 wave for quite some time, doing freelance editing, both online, but more often in a nonlinear room. My experience with Media 100 actually opened up my eyes and my world to Apple. My situation in life was not coming at anything with a lot of money. So even back when I was younger, Apple computers, I was aware of them, but Apple computers were a premium product. Couldn't afford Apple. But I was a big fan of the Amiga platform. And I had video toasters and Amiga-related hardware. Actually, before even the video toaster, they had something called the A-Squared. A-Squared Live, I think it was called. And it was a digitizer for the Amiga. Very low quality, but real time. And I sort of knew that that was going to be a good platform for me. And I got into Amiga before Apple, but through Media 100, that ran on Apple hardware. And through that system, which was, it was a good system, but it was buggy. I mean, it relied on Apple to provide hardware and the operating system for it to be stable, and it wasn't really stable. But through that experience, I actually built up a fair amount of knowledge on how to keep systems up and running, how to troubleshoot them, because literally every day with the Media 100 would start with a phone call to their tech support, and we would walk through, you know, system extensions and memory errors and bent pins on SCSI drive cables and things like that. And through many, many years of owning a Media 100 system, troubleshooting a Media 100 system, I had built up a fair amount of experience with Apple hardware. And I actually started, as that production work started to go in-house for most things, the need for external editing was being diminished. I found new opportunity as a system integrator, as a system builder, as a system consultant, or even just a technician to keep people's systems running. So I became an Apple consultant, part of the Apple Consultants Network. And I had a very good business doing consulting work for video companies using Apple hardware. And I met some people at Apple. They were doing a big push around Final Cut Pro 1.0. I was in that system on the ground floor. I actually saw Final Cut Pro way back at Video Expo New York. And it was actually a product owned, as you probably know, by Macromedia called Key Grip. Though the name didn't make a lot of sense to me back then, the software looked amazing. I remember seeing it behind a curtain in the back of the booth, and I was blown away by what the potential of that product was. Fast forward a few years later, Apple buys it. It becomes Final Cut Pro 1.0. I'm working with Apple as a consultant and doing Final Cut Pro demonstrations and presentations and things like that. That led me to open an Apple resellership, an Apple value-added reseller, vertical industry for video production. So we specialized in building and selling Apple systems for editors. And I had a big space, had a training center. We were actually the first Apple training center in New Jersey. And we did a lot of Apple editing systems and training, and just a great business at the time, before Apple stores existed, before there was a lot of web-based communities. That Apple reseller business was going gangbusters, you know, all the way through Final Cut 5, 6, 7, and then Apple started opening up Apple stores. And they started selling direct to bigger customers through Apple Enterprise. And they were taking business away from resellers. So I sort of was being forced out of the market that I was in by Apple, with their own stores and their own internal sales organizations. Through that Apple resellership, I started the New Jersey Final Cut Pro user group. This was back when the user groups were in their heyday. I found that there was a need for people who didn't want to go into New York to have a meeting, have a place to discuss issues and see product and demonstrations. And we had a great, great group. Through that group, I was introduced to a producer at a corporation, and I started getting back into production work through some requests that they had for work. And as the Apple reseller business started to go away by the nature of Apple, I was doing more and more production work at the corporate level. And what was great was this was at a level where the budgets were unlimited and the opportunities were great. And again, in this time of pre-2008, things were soaring. International work, big crews, multiple cameras, high visibility productions. And it was great. And I'm still doing that work, even though the budgets have been corrected since 2008 a bit, but it's still going strong and I still do that work today. This variety in my background has always given me opportunities to learn, to make mistakes, and to correct those mistakes and build from it. You have to be flexible. You have to be available to do anything that you can to get work. And I think that diversity has helped me in my career as a problem solver, as a creative editor, as a creative cameraman. I feel I use that diversity to my advantage to help my jobs run smoothly and creatively and to solve problems on the fly. And I think that's the biggest strength that I have is to be able to take a situation and, you know, production doesn't always go by the book and be able to manage the risks, deal with the problems that come up, and turn it into a win on all sides for all interested parties. So that's my past. I am a Final Cut Pro editor. I made the leap to 10 when it first came out. I've never looked back, though there was a point where I was a little surprised at the direction that 10 took. I was forced, in a way, to use 10. I was on a job where we were editing Final Cut 7, and I didn't have enough licenses to go around. I was the odd man out. I was forced to edit a whole month-long job in 10, and that sort of forced my hand to learn it, to embrace it, and that is my platform of choice today. And there's many reasons that I like Final Cut 10, mainly because it's efficient, it's fast, and it's flexible. So I'm a Final Cut Pro editor. I've got a Varicam production package that I use. I have 3 Varicam LTs. I've got a set of Canon Cine Primes. I've got a couple of Canon Cine Zooms, the 17-120 and the 50-1000. I have drones. I'm big into aerial videography. I have a series of DJI drones, including an Inspire 2 and a Mavic. I have lots of other gear, and I love new technology, and I love using new things to help tell a story. And all of those things I hope to roll into this new podcast, which I am calling This Week in Production. I hope this background will give you a little perspective on where I hope to bring topics and content going forward. So give me a chance, give me a listen. We'll make this journey together. I hope you have a great week.